It is really a privilege to be here this weekend. I joked around. I know I've known Tom Herman for a while, but he knows me from Michigan. So when I was sitting on the boardwalk, and I'm the marketing director at the camp back home, so I usually have khakis and a polo shirt on. He walked up on the boardwalk. I said, "Hey, Tom, like, we're best buds." And he just kind of looked at me like, "Which one of the 10 million people are you that I've met in the course of me speaking?" But this is really who I am, and I've been able to be coming to the ranch for a long time, being put into by Matt and by Lou and Donnie and our tight friends. And this has just been a special place for me. I grew up in camp. I'm fourth generation in a row in Christian camping. It's in my blood. And I was telling Tom, what an incredible industry where I can go to a competitor and be ministered to and be filled up. I will tell you a little bit about how I got to know the ranch in Lou. My mom is a consultant. She worked with the staff here a number of years ago and helped them do some planning. And in the course of the time, she knew I liked horses. I was probably about 10 years old. She bought a bunch of Lou's videos, brought them home, and I watched them just nonstop. Well, then we worked it out for Lou to come do a camp at our camp for a week. And he came with Miss Melody and Donnie, and a guy named Jonathan came. And I was about 15 or 16 at that time, and at the end of our week on Thursdays, we would go on a wagon ride and go down to the ice cream shop with all the kids. So we invited the Starrets and Donnie and Jonathan to come with us, and I was working on staff as a horse trainer, and I had a little flexibility, so I invited my girlfriend to come visit and come out on the ride with me. I didn't get to see her very often. She didn't work at camp. I did. You don't have a lot of free time. So I invited her to come on the ride with me, and, you know, I kind of wanted to introduce her to these folks that I really liked and looked up to. We got back from the wagon ride, and Donnie and Jonathan come up alongside me, and they said, "Ryan, we got to talk to you." I said, "Okay." And they pulled me down in downstairs part of the barn into the foaling pen. It was dark. There was, like, interrogation lights hanging over our head. And they looked at me, and they said, "Ryan, we don't think she's right for you." I said, "What?" They said, "We can't put our finger on it. There's nothing specific, but we just don't think she's right for you. I'd like to introduce you to that little lady. She's my wife of 6 years." This is Kendra and my son Colton, and just absolute love of my life, and that tells you how high I respect Donnie's opinion. But I really like Matt, and Lou's been incredible in my life. I share a little bit about where I came from. I do have to be honest with you, before I got saved, I wasn't the good-looking guy you see in front of you. Matter of fact, before I came to the Lord, I really didn't want anything to do with God. I was selfish, I was angry, I was bitter, I was mean, I'd lash out all the time. I had no reason to care about what some cosmic force in the universe has to say about my life. And then things really started to turn south, and about the time I turned 4 years old, I decided it was time to quit all this foolishness and give my life to the Lord. I have been incredibly blessed to grow up under an amazing godly heritage. Like I said, fourth generation in a row in Christian camping. My grandfather is the patriarch of my family. And Tom talked about books, Bibles. This is a copy of the Bible that my grandfather gave me. It has all of his notes on it. And the one he gave me, he carried for 20 years. And it was so valuable to me, I started carrying it for a year or two. And the binding in it just started to fall apart. And so I'll tell you later in the story, but I went through and I copied every single highlight, every single note, every single tittle that he had from that Bible to this one, because it's so incredible as I read through this to see my grandfather's thought process as he studied Scripture for 25 years. So I thought that was kind of an interesting parallel there. But growing up in a church and growing up in ministry, you hear things all the time. Everything happens for a reason. It is well. We sing these songs, Refiner's Fire. And it's easy to say and pray and believe those things when everything's going well. And for me, life was going well. I met Kendra when I was 15, high school sweethearts, dated through high school. I was a sophomore that got moved up on varsity basketball, and she was the senior cheerleader, and I thought pretty highly of myself at that time. But I've always been a successful kid. I played 4 varsity sports, 10 varsity letters. I graduated with a year and a half of college. I went out to Wyoming when I was 16 and worked for a horse trainer. First time I'd ever flown. I was out there for 10 weeks by myself. If ever I wanted to do something, There never seemed to be anything I couldn't put my mind to and work my way out of or into and get done what I needed to get done. I was just always one of those kids that could do what they wanted to do, and things worked out, and it went well. So I dated Kendra for a long time, and then we got married pretty young. I was 20, she was 21. We were pretty much babies. And went to school, graduated, got a job right out of the graduation into the industry that I wanted to be in, working at Grace Adventures as their ranch manager. Kendra and I continued to get to know each other, and before too long, Colton was born. We just bought a new house. She'd just gotten promoted. I'd just gotten promoted to the marketing director. This is about 2 years ago. Everything was just going perfect. We had our plans. We were going to do this and this and this. She had her professional plan. I had my professional plan. We were about ready to add on a big addition to our house so we could grow into it with our family. Everything was going the way we wanted. And it's easy to say, God is sovereign. Everything happens for a reason. Let's back up a little bit. When I was 20, through a series of events, I got diagnosed with a very rare liver disease. And we came to become aware of it, and we found a doctor at the University of Chicago, one of the world's leading hepatologists, and we started to keep an eye on things. And so every 6 months, I'd go down to Chicago for tests and scans, and it became very routine. So for 5 years, we'd done that. And April of 2011 was one of those times where I went down late March, and it became so routine, I went by myself. And I remember calling Chad, who's a good friend of mine, one of my best friends that Matt talked about on the way down. I said, Chad, I got a bad feeling about this one. I don't know why. For 5 years, twice a year, everything came back stable. No worries. He says, don't worry about it, Ryan. That's normal. Then he did what a good friend does. Went down, had the test. Everything was great 6 months ago. My blood work looked great. And I come home and I wait for the results from the scans. And I remember the day. It was April 1st, 2011. And in Michigan, it's just one of those beautiful, crisp spring mornings. We've got horses. I went out and shored them as I was doing my morning devotions and routine. You see the breath coming out of their nostrils. The grass is green. There's dew on the ground. It's just one of those days that makes you feel good, like I'm going to go attack today and get done what I've got to get done. Went to work, and I knew the call was coming, and so it finally came in, and the doctor starts the call out with, are you sitting down? And I said, yeah, doc, what's the deal? He says, Ryan, I know that we just met 3 days ago and you are as healthy as an ox. Your blood work looked good. 6 months ago, you were fine. And I know that I told you not to worry about that really, really rare cancer that's sometimes related to your disease. I told you that it's premature to talk about a liver transplant right now because there's no reason. You're fine. Ryan, I don't know how to tell you this. You've got spots on your liver. Ryan, I matter of fact, I don't know I can do anything for you anymore. And it seems to be spreading fairly quickly. I don't recommend that you go to our oncology department at the University of Chicago Hospital. I recommend you go to Mayo. Maybe they've got a protocol that they could do a transplant or something, but it's really out of our hands at this point. They're probably your only shot. And I hung up the phone and I was sitting at my desk. I'm 25 years old and I didn't have a clue what to do. My whole world had just been shaken. Everything I'd been building towards had just fallen underneath me. And my wife was at home on spring break, and so I called her. And she wanted to tell me something Colton had done during the day. And I said, honey, I got to tell you something. She said, okay. And I said, the doctor just called, and I explained it to her. And she says, no, Ryan, It's April 1st. I know you. You're kind of a jerk, Ryan. It's April Fool's Day. And this is a low one, Ryan, even for you. I said, honey, I'm not joking. I'm not joking. She said, no, Ryan, you got to be joking. Ryan, tell me that you're joking. Ryan, please tell me that you're joking. Ryan, I'm going to be really, really mad at you at this point, but you just need to tell me that this is a joke. And I heard her voice start to crack, and my voice started to crack, and I think that's when it settled in for her that I wasn't joking. And that's when it settled in for me that this was going to affect a whole lot more than me. This was going to affect my whole family in a pretty drastic way. And so we packed up and we headed out to Mayo Clinic, and we drove out there, my folks and Colton and Kendra and I, and we had not known if we were going to be there for 6 months or 6 days. We had no idea what the future looked like. No answers. Diagnosis is the hardest time. That week or so afterwards, you can't ask the questions, you can't put the plan together. I'm a doer, right? I wanted to fix everything. And I couldn't fix this one. And we drove out there, and I remember staring at the clouds, and I said, God, just give me a sign. Give me a sign everything's going to be okay. I don't know if you've ever tried your hands at cloud divination. Maybe that's on the what do we call that? I can't remember. It's a female thing. Sorry, I forget stuff constantly. But I'm no good at cloud divination. I didn't get the answer I was looking for. And so we went out to Mayo, and we waited for a doctor to see us, and finally he takes Ken and I back into his office after about 4 days of waiting. And he sits us down, and he says, what do you know? I said, well, Doc, we know it's serious, but we're hoping we can do chemo or radiation or surgery and get cancer-free, and then maybe we can do a liver transplant, because that's the only cure for my disease or my cancer. It's liver bile duct cancer, and so they can't do any, there's no cure for it. It's so rare, and it's so aggressive, and it's so unknown that they don't have a cure for it. He says, Ryan, that's not going to be an option. Ryan, you're stage 4, which if you know anything about cancer, stage 1 would be the least worst. Stage 4 would be the worst. He says, Ryan, you're stage 4. Matter of fact, I don't have a whole lot of options for you. I don't recommend that you face trials all over the country. I don't recommend that you do aggressive forms of chemotherapy. It's not going to really work. It may give you a couple of weeks or months, but it's just going to ruin your life. He says, you need to go home and put your affairs in order and enjoy the time that you have. I said, what are we talking about, Doc? He says, you got less than a year. That was April 14th, 2010.
Wow.
Colton's first birthday. And I said, Doc, it's not good enough. It's my son's birthday. I've got to be around. I can't, that's not going to work. And I argued with him, and I got angry, and it didn't matter. He wasn't going to change his mind. And so we got in the car, and we packed up, and we headed for home. There wasn't any more reason for us to be at Mayo. And we had a decision to make at that moment. Were we gonna let this news, this change in our lives, ruin my son's birthday? Or were we gonna be able to choose our attitude no matter what our circumstances? And so we stopped at a roadside diner, I don't know where, and we went inside and we smashed blueberry pie in his face and we sang him happy birthday. And I've got pictures and you can see the bloodshot eyes in my wife and my eyes and the tears that were fighting back. But we made a decision beyond, even earlier than this. From the moment I was diagnosed, there was just this incredible change. And we had a tough choice at that moment. You see, does our faith define our circumstances, or do our circumstances define our faith? Was God the same God after cancer that he was before? Because if he wasn't, he was never God to begin with. And so we made a decision that we can't control what's going to happen in our lives, but we are going to control how we respond. And if you've done the math, it's been a little over a year now, coming up on a year and a half, actually. Everybody tells me I'm the healthiest sick person you've ever seen. And I feel pretty well for the most part, and I'm going to tell you a few more details. But over the last year or so, people come up to me all the time, and we've gotten to know quite a few people, and I've spoke quite a bit, and we have a blog that's really popular. And they say, you know, Ryan, how you doing? And I get asked that almost everywhere I go. How you doing, Ryan? And to be honest with you, it's been the worst year of my life. It has been everything I could imagine times 10. The first couple of weeks on chemotherapy, I lost 15 pounds in 3 days, puking and just wrenching your guts out. I've been doing aggressive chemotherapy for about 14 months. I went through 10 weeks of radiation. And it just, my body is completely and totally worn down. If you haven't seen my wife and I around much in the evenings or in the afternoons, it's not because my 2-year-old has to go rest, it's because I do. I've been around horses and sports my whole life. There's days I can't even put out a 50-pound square bale. I can't open up the jars. I'm weaker physically than I've ever been in my life. Emotionally and mentally, it has just been grueling. You constantly feel like you have this ticker over your head that's counting down, and you never know what it really says. You just feel that pressure on you all the time of, I don't know how much time I have. And the emotions of being given a terminal diagnosis when you're 25 and your son's 1 year old, and trying to navigate how do you move forward? It's just been, there have been times where I've found myself screaming and yelling at Kendra, and I don't even know what we're arguing about. You know? I had to go to the eye doctor the other day and get my glasses fixed. And she said, and they were messed up. She says, did your son step on them or something? I said, I wish. I got really, really mad and I threw him against the wall in a fit of rage. She was like 80 years old. She didn't know how to handle that one. Oh my! It's been the worst year of my life. Spiritually, it's been a battle at times. And I just want to be honest with you guys. It stinks. And throughout that entire time, it's also been the best year of my life. I've never experienced life like I have in the last 16 months. You see, the moment I got that phone call, something changed. And I've been a Christian most of my life. And I've had highs and lows and valleys and ridgetops. And this is different. This is totally different. It's like my eyes were open to seeing God in a new way, more than I'd ever seen Him before in my life. See, I said I was born early, and Tom talked about the difference between him and his wife. My wife's kind of the same. She was the first one saved in her family when she was in high school. And I've always been amazed at how different salvation is for her than it is for me. I took so much for granted. It's just always been a part of my life. I didn't know anything different. But for the first time in my life, I was totally dependent on God. Not for the first time. First time I understood it. I couldn't take for granted anymore that I'm going to have a tomorrow, or a next month, or a next year. I couldn't take for granted that my dreams and my future are going to take place. Everything was ripped out from under me, and I had to really look inside hard at myself and say, what's left? And I felt so powerless. My whole life I felt so powerful, but for the first time I was absolutely powerless and I didn't know how I was going to get out of it. And so God became more real, almost tangible. I knew that He cared about every step we had along this journey. My relationship with my wife, we'd been married for 4 years and 11 months when I got diagnosed. We renewed our vows on our 5-year anniversary a month after I was diagnosed. And it's incredible the difference in my heart that those vows meant at that stage in my life than when I was 20. And so I just want to cherish her and spend as much time with her as I could. And Colton, I took so much for granted and the things I'd be able to do with him and would not want to change diapers or maybe put him down. Now I wanted to take advantage of every moment I had. I didn't want to miss anything. I didn't know how much time I was going to have with him. And so it was too valuable to me to waste my time. And the things that I used to waste my time on, all of a sudden lost their appeal. Whether it was success at work, and I don't take that the wrong way. I still work really hard at Grace. But to move up professionally in your career focus, whether it's what other people think about me, or the vehicle I drive, or the house that we own, or the horses that I have, none of it mattered anymore. I watch sports a lot, and I still do, but beforehand I would just get really into the sports or politics. And all of a sudden, it just lost the interest. And the only thing that matters to me is, how much time do I have? And am I going to be obedient with the time that God's given me? And so Kendra and I call it seeing in high definition. Because we feel like our eyes were open to seeing the world for the first time on high def. And the colors this winter and this fall have been more beautiful. Everything has just been different. And I'm not trying to be dishonest. It's been the worst year of my life, too. But it's also been the best year of my life. And if you had to ask me most of the time, I think I could be honest with you and tell you I wouldn't go back. I wouldn't exchange knowing or thinking I knew what the future meant for the way that I was living my life before. And I wasn't living it in sin. I was working at a Christian camp. I didn't have huge areas in my life that I needed to reconcile. But I wasn't living completely and totally sold out for God. I'd been distracted and caught off guard, and I'd left doors cracked that kept me from fulfilling the purpose that God had given me. And so now I know what my purpose is, no matter how much time I have. It's to hopefully help people see life the way that I see it, no matter what, without having to go through what I'm going through. And I don't know if I'm going to be gone tomorrow or a month or 6 months or 6 years or 60 years, but I know what my purpose is from here on forward. And it just has changed and inspired me to live my life in a completely and totally different way. And so I wanted to share some things that over the last year God's really laid on tenders in my heart, because as you're sitting here, you're probably going, yeah, I've been through some tough times, and maybe you can't relate to stage 4 of terminal cancer. Maybe you can't. I know that there's folks that are going through cancer, or have, or your family, or tough times, and there's a family not here because their daughter's dealing with seizures. We're all going to face opportunities and tough times and challenges. And a lot of people will come up to me and go, Ryan, I'm going through this, but it's nothing like what you're going through. And I say, you know what? It is. The feelings that you're feeling are just as real. And the God that you serve is the same God I serve, and He's told me that I have what I need for today, so I guarantee He's got what you need for today. So we're called to respond the same way, no matter how significant we feel like it is. And so I don't know where you're sitting today, but I want to share some things about obedience that God's laid on our heart throughout the last year and a half. Because some of the adrenaline has worn off, and there have been a lot of times now where it's down to choice. We don't feel like doing it. It doesn't make sense sometimes, but am I going to commit my will to overcoming my mind or my heart sometimes? And the verse that's really summed this year and a half up for us is 2 Corinthians 1:9. And here Paul says, in our hearts we felt the sentence of death. Or we felt like we've been given the sentence of death. But that was to turn our eyes away from ourselves and on to God, who brings people back to life. And I don't know if I'm going to be healed physically or not, but can I tell you, I've got a new life than what I had before. And I've been healed. I was healed when I was 4 years old and I made that first decision. And thank God that that wasn't the end of the process. And that I can still continue in my growth and in molding of how I come to know Him. And I've been transformed one more time. And I said I felt powerless before. But 2 Peter 1:3, which you're just going to feel like you're getting a lot of the same stuff over and over again, because a lot of the scriptures that have been quoted. Well, first he quotes half the Bible. It's kind of like drinking from a fire hose. But I think it's a Holy Spirit thing. There's a lot of similarities between where Tom's gone this weekend and what I wanted to share. But 2 Peter 1:3, and I don't want to mess this one up, so I want to share it with you. I said I felt powerless. And this is the promise that I really have relied on for a lot of times when I didn't know how I was going to get out of bed in the morning or how I was going to answer the phone call when a friend of mine died from cancer. Am I still on? Did I lose you? Okay. Sorry. Oh, that's 2 Corinthians. Nope, I don't want that. I want 2 Peter. Here we go. And the reality is I am weaker than I've ever been. Physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. But 2 Peter 1:3 says, seeing that His divine power has given us everything we need pertaining to life and godliness through the true knowledge of Him who called us by His own glory and excellence. You see, I know I've been given, I'm powerless, but He's absolutely powerful. And if I'm willing to submit myself, I have everything that I need for life. But not just to survive. You see, God doesn't want us to just get through valleys. For life and for godliness. To do it in a way that pleases Him no matter what I'm facing. And so the first thing I want to share with you is that obedience isn't dependent upon our circumstances. We pray, Lord, Your will be done. But a lot of times what we mean is, Lord, here's what I want You to do. Do what I tell You to. And I'm going to throw this caveat in there so that I feel better. But You better do what I ask You to do. And when a tragedy happens, a lot of times we have those foxhole prayers. God, if You get me out of this, I will do anything You ask me to do. And our obedience is dependent upon whether or not the circumstances work out the way we want them to. Or maybe before a tragedy, so long as things are going well, we're willing to say God's in control. But have you ever met somebody that felt like God was angry at them? Or that they were bitter because they felt like God was out to get them? And so their circumstances usually don't work out, and they don't blame themselves, they blame God. And so for me, the real first question was, do I have to be obedient? I've had this terrible thing happen to me. Do I still have to respond the same way to stubbing my toe that anybody else does? Don't I get a free pass? Don't I get to go do all those things that since I've been a Christian my whole life, I never got to do, but now I want to go do? Or what about a bucket list? You see, I meet a lot of folks that have been diagnosed with serious or terminal cancers, and I've seen some of them come and go. And I've met a lot of folks that tell me about their bucket list. And I got to be honest with you, I don't have a bucket list. Yeah, I'm going to go on a vacation in two weeks and go packing and trailing. And there's things that I'd like to do. But when I get to heaven, it's what drives me. And that doesn't drive me. Those are things that if it works out and God allows it to happen, fabulous. And I'm going to thank Him that I can even go. But what drives me is to be obedient. Because when I get to heaven, God's not going to ask me, Ryan, how many vacations did you go on? How many horses did you break? How many guns did you buy? How many mountains did you climb? He's going to ask me, Ryan, what did you do with the widow and the orphan and the lost? And just because I have stage 4 cancer doesn't mean I'm any less obligated to serve the people around me that He puts in my life. And so, obedience isn't dependent upon our circumstances. The second one is obedience isn't dependent on whether it makes sense. I like to think I'm a smart guy. My wife would probably argue with me at times. But there's a lot of things about how I got cancer that don't make a lick of sense. And people can't figure it out. I've been told so many times, Ryan, I don't know, by doctors, that I'm starting to think, anybody can be a doctor. Half the time they say, I don't know. My cancer, my disease, usually hits women over 50. I'm not that demographic, in case you couldn't tell. It's slow moving. Mine was 0 to stage 4 in 6 months. I was trying to live my life in a way that would honor God. I wasn't out trying to be rich or famous or anything like that. I had good motives. Working in full-time ministry. Newborn child. Why me? You know? A lot of people, it doesn't make sense, Ryan. A couple months ago, we've been about a year into it. And every time we go and get scans, it's one of the most difficult times. You're waiting for the results. And the doctor's going to come in, and your life can change based on what that piece of paper says. And so we call it scanxiety, and it kind of builds as we get closer. A couple of months ago, we had scans, and I remember telling Kendra, I just want to be up in the infusion center, which meant we met the doctor. It hadn't strengthened, but it hadn't grown. It was status quo. It was average. And like 7 out of 8 times, that's what we'd had over the last year. And then we go up, and we get my chemo infusion, and we go home, and we just kind of keep waiting for another couple months, hoping that everything stays the same. I was afraid that it started growing again. And so instead of saying, maybe this is the time that God's going to allow it to start shrinking, I said, I just want average. I just want status quo. That's what made sense to me. We met with the doctor. He comes in. He says, Ryan, I don't know how to tell you this. I'm sorry, but it started to grow again. And I was devastated because I'd started to kind of expect that maybe it's just going to keep average for a long time. And we started talking about different options, and finally says, I think you need to go talk to the radiation oncologist. And so we went and talked to him the next day. And that doctor comes in, and the first thing he says is, I don't understand palliative treatment in your case. I think we can be aggressive and go after all of it. I think we can get it all. I said, what are you talking about, doc? They've told me that that's never going to happen. He says, no, I've looked at your scans and the way it's laid out. I think we can do it. And he saw my belt buckle, and there's a cowboy kneeling on the cross. He said, you're a Christian. I said, yes, sir, I am. He says, well, that's the most important part because you've got to be praying, and I'm going to be praying, and this is just how God uses my hands to heal people, but we're going to be praying through this whole thing, and this is just a tool. And so we got in the car, and we drove home, and I said, honey, you know, I just wanted average because I was afraid. But we had to have bad news, or else we would have just kept doing the chemo. And once we got the bad news, it forced us to go talk to this other doctor who told us he might be able to have a cure. And 4 weeks ago, we got the scan results that were since the first time since we have had radiation, and everything's disappeared except for 2 small spots. They're pretty sure they can get those spots. I ended up getting an infection the week later. I was in the hospital for a week, and that's kind of why we didn't know if I was going to be here or not. They had to do scans because of trying to find where the infection came from. And the spots had shrunk even more in less than a week, and I hadn't done any more treatment. And they think they're going to get it all, and they've got options, and they're very optimistic now. But if it was made sense to me, I just want average. And so we have to be obedient even when it doesn't make sense. Proverbs 3 through 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him. Not just when it makes sense. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and flee from evil. Be obedient. Don't try to make it make sense. Just fear the Lord and be obedient. It'll be healing to your body and encouragement to your bones. We have to be obedient even when it doesn't make sense. It didn't make sense to me why God might take Colton away from me, or take me away from him. And I really struggled with that. And every time I'd tuck him in and pray with him, I'd wonder, how many more times am I going to get to do this? Until finally one day God said, you know what, Ryan? He's never been yours to begin with. He's got a father that loves him better than you can. He's going to take care of him more than you will, and has better plans for him than you do. Matter of fact, you consider yourself thankful that I gave him to you for whatever time I decide to give him to you, and make sure you take advantage of the time that you have. And all of a sudden, what I thought was a right became a privilege. And so if God chooses to take things away that used to be rights, I get resentful. Because it doesn't make sense. I deserve it. I have earned it. But if it's a privilege, I didn't earn it, I don't deserve it, God can come and give and take as much as he wants, and I'm still thankful for what he's given me. And that's what a year of living obedience has helped change my heart and my perspective. The last one I want to share with you right now is that obedience requires a complete and total dependence upon God. You see, I told you that I grew up pretty successful, and I would have told you that I was blessed. I grew up in a Christian home. I grew up in America, and I would have said, God bless me. But that was a pretty thinly veiled allusion to all the hard work I'd put in. All the practicing and lifting and studying and training and reading and all the work. I think I'm a pretty sharp, hardworking, intelligent guy. So I would tell you that God had blessed me beyond anything I deserved, but it was a thinly veiled allusion to the credit I was trying to take for myself. And then I had the rug pulled out from under me. And I must be a hard learner because it took something really, really big to get a hold of my heart. Now I feel a little bit better because as I read through the Bible, I see a few stories that it took a few heavy hitters, as we talked about, to get a hold of their heart. And Paul, I think, was in a similar spot. You see, he was wealthy, successful, political, educated. He was doing his plan. Everything was going the way he wanted it to go, right? According to how it made sense to him. And then on the road to Damascus, he literally has a come-to-Jesus meeting. I mean, not figuratively, he meets the man. And I've lost a lot of my ability over the last year and a half. I only have about 50% feeling in my toes, 90% in my hands. I drop stuff constantly. Mentally, I have what's called chemo brain a lot. And I can't process my thoughts and get my words out right or my emotions, and it's just exhausting. I can't imagine what it feels like the first couple of days you go from total sight to total blindness. How completely and totally helpless you must feel. And in order to get a hold of God's heart, or Paul's heart, God had to remove every sense of self-dependence that Paul had. He's completely dependent on those around him for 3 days. And I think he finally understood that obedience really is a factor of our understanding of our dependence upon God. Because when he came out of that, he's a changed man. And when I start to realize I have everything despite of me, not because of me, that I don't deserve to have been born where I was born any more than I could have been born an orphan in a gutter to a prostitute in a third world country. And if I should have been born there and I've been born here, I can't take credit for anything I've given or been done. And so I'm completely dependent on God. And if I'm dependent, I am also protected. That's the God I serve. See, he's going to call me to do things, but he's also given me the promises that he's going to give me the grace to do them. The power for life and for godliness. And so when I start to realize it's despite of me and not because of me, it transforms how I live. And we talk about this refining process. I'm a new person even from a year and a half ago. I have, my heart, my mind has been changed. God is different in my world. But so many times when somebody goes through this, and I wrote a blog telling people, make sure you're praying for God's will to be done before you pray for me to be healed. Because we pray and we say this refining fire process, right? We want to be refined. We want to be this new person. We want to have the character change. Lord, break our hearts. But we don't really think about that. What that process has to happen. The refining fire has to be so hot that gold physically changes its state and melts. You cannot be the same metal before that you are after if you're refined. And Deuteronomy says, and I want to get this right, or Proverbs 17:3, the refining pot is for silver and the furnace is for gold, but the Lord tests hearts. And so many times we see somebody struggle and we try to pray them out of the fire because it's uncomfortable for us to watch. And yet it's that fire that God's using to do something incredible in their life. But it may not make sense. We may not understand it. It won't feel right. And we sure can't see how God's protecting them through it. But we have to lean on those promises when it doesn't make sense. And so, I don't know what you're headed home to. I don't know what you're going to face tomorrow when you get home or next week. Kenner and I will keep going with treatment. I just did treatment on Monday, and I had to wear a pump for 48 hours with the chemo, and I got it taken out on Wednesday. And I'll have nine days off after that, and then I start it again. And this whole cycle, I'll start all over again where I don't feel well and I can't process. And so when I'm in the grind, when I'm in the day-to-day, how do I keep my eyes focused on God regardless of my circumstances? And how do I continue to be obedient? It's simple, but it's not easy. And what I found is if I can keep an eternal perspective, then my earthly actions are going to be reflective of that. And I think there's a passage that really summarizes it. And I don't know why, but I've spent a lot of time with Paul, and specifically 2 Corinthians lately. And in 2 Corinthians 4:16, he says, "Therefore we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we're wasting away, yet inwardly we're being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary struggles are achieving for us a divine glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but what is unseen. Because what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal." Now think about that, guys. This is Paul. After he gave his life to the Lord, in prison, sentenced to death, stoned, shipwrecked, lost at sea, starved, lost all of his money. About everything imaginable I can think of bad happens to this guy. And then the thorn in the side, who knows what that was. And he says, "My light and momentary struggle." If anything that could happen to us could be light and momentary when compared to the glory that we have ahead of us, how does that not transform how we live our lives on a day-to-day basis? But we have to keep our eyes on what is unseen. And I was at a church last week, and they gave a missionary report from a trip to Africa. And they're showing the pictures. And here's they're at an orphanage, some third world village. Kids with no noses, you know, just the worst kid scenarios you can imagine. And the name of the orphanage is Beautiful Gate. And they show a picture of the team in front of the gate. It's the ugliest gate I've ever seen in my life. I'm speaking in one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in Grand Rapids, Michigan, okay? This church is well off. Nobody would, I mean, they would tear the whole house down if they had a gate like that, okay? But what made that gate beautiful wasn't what you could see. It was what was unseen. And that's the eternal perspective. And so as you guys head home, my encouragement for you is if you're willing to make that commitment to live 100% in obedience and to see life in high definition, then no matter what you're going to face, whether you're walking through the valley of the shadow of death and there's demons and there's dragons at the cliff tops shooting arrows trying to steal you of your joy, you will be able to say, "The joy of the Lord is my strength." Amen. And you will know that you are walking in the direction He's called you. I don't know what tomorrow holds, but I know I've been given grace for today. And if you're willing to live your life that way, it's going to completely change your family, the legacy you leave, what you remember by. I was at a funeral for a friend. Kendra was 2 years behind his wife in high school. She was 4 years behind him in high school, and I was 2 years behind Kendra. So we all kind of knew each other. Small town. He was diagnosed with stage 4 stomach cancer a month before I was. And so for a year, we'd walk alongside them going through similar experiences. And their faith is sketchy if they have one. And he died three or four months ago and went to the funeral. And he was a big four-wheeler, mudding, trucking kind of guy. And so all these folks came that were in his clubs, and there were all these bumper stickers that they made for him. And it just struck me, and there's nothing against bumper stickers, but I don't want to be remembered as a bumper sticker.